She has heard the stories, these statistics. Most airline pilots die before they reach retirement age, which is 60. It's the stress, the strain of the unusual schedules, the wear and tear on the body. She moves toward him, tucks her hands around his stiffened arm. Still, he stares straight ahead. Jack, tell me, what is it? Drop it, will you? Stung, she lets his arm go and walks away. It's the weather, he says, catching up to her. I don't know. Apologetic now, mollifying. What about the weather? She asks coldly, unwilling to be so easily mollified. The gray, the fog, I hate it. I don't think anyone likes it much, she says evenly. Catherine, you don't understand. He removes his hands from his pockets and hikes his collar against the cold. He seems to slip further into his leather jacket. Today is my mother's birthday, he says quietly, or would have been. Oh, Jack, she says, going to him. You should have said. You're lucky, he says. You're lucky to have Julia. You say you didn't have parents, but you did. Is this a note of jealousy that she hears? Yes, I am lucky to have Julia, she agrees. Jack's face is pinched and red. His eyes are watering from the cold. Was it very bad when your mother died? She asks. I don't like to talk about it. I know you don't, she says gently, but sometimes talking about it can make it better. I doubt it. Was she sick a long time? He hesitates. Not too long. It was quick. What was it? I told you, cancer. No, I know, she says. I mean, what kind? He sighs slightly. Breast, he says. In those days, they didn't have the kinds of treatments. She puts her hand on his arm. It's a terrible age to be left without a mother, she says. Just 4 years older than Maddie, she thinks suddenly, and the realization makes her go cold all over. It is agonizing to think of Maddie left without a mother. She was Irish, you once said. She was born there. She had a beautiful voice, a beautiful accent. You had your dad. Jack makes a short, derisive sound. Dad isn't exactly the correct word. My father was an asshole. The word, which Jack seldom uses, shocks her. She unzips his jacket, snakes her arms inside. Jack, she says. He softens slightly and pulls her head toward him. She smells leather mixed with sea air. I don't know what it is, he says. Sometimes I'm afraid. Sometimes I think I have no center on gray days, no beliefs. You have me, she says quickly. This is true. You have Maddie, she says. I know, of course. Aren't we enough? She asks. Where is Maddie? He asks, suddenly pulling away. Catherine whips around and scans the beach. Jack spots her first, a brief flash of red among the gray. Catherine, inexplicably paralyzed, watches Jack race across the sand and wade with high steps into the waves. She waits an endless minute and then sees Jack snatch Maddie like a small dog from the surf. He holds his daughter face down by the waist, and she thinks for a moment that he will shake Maddie dry like a dog as well. But then she hears a familiar cry. Jack kneels on the beach, whips off his leather jacket, and enfolds the small body. When Catherine reaches the two of them, he is wiping seawater from his daughter's face with the tail of his shirt. Maddie looks stunned. The wave knocked her down, Jack says breathlessly, and the undertow was taking her out. Catherine picks Maddie up, cradles her in her arms. Let's go, Jack says quickly. In a minute, she'll be freezing. They begin to walk fast back to the house. Maddie coughs and wheezes from the seawater. Catherine murmurs soothing words. Maddie's face is bright pink from the cold. Jack holds Maddie's hand as if attached to his daughter by an umbilical cord. His pants are soaked, his shirt untucked. Catherine thinks that he too must be freezing. The thought of what might have happened to Maddie had he not seen her in time weakens her arms, her knees. She stops abruptly on the beach, and in a natural movement, Jack encircles her and Maddie with his arms. "Aren't we enough?" she asks again. Jack bends his head and kisses Catherine on her forehead. "Enough of what?" Maddie asks. 2. Sometimes it was as though she had lived 3, 4 years in 11 days. At other times, it seemed just minutes ago that Robert Hart stood at her door and uttered the two words, "Mrs. Lyons," that had changed her life. She could not remember time looping in on itself in such a manner before, except perhaps for those 2 or 3 sublime days when she had first met Jack Lyons and fallen in love, and life had been measured out in minutes rather than in hours. She lay on the day bed in the spare room, her arms outstretched, her head slightly raised on a pillow so that she could see past the red lacquered chair and out to sea. It was sunny when she'd driven to the house, but now the sky was beginning to cloud over, just swirls of cloud, milk drops in a water glass. She pulled a butterfly clip from the back of her head and tossed it to the floor, where it skidded along the polished wooden boards and came to rest against the baseboard. She had meant that morning to re-enter the house and begin the long process of cleaning up and clearing away all traces of the past 11 days so that Maddie and she might move back from Julia's and begin their lives again. The gesture had been an admirable one, Catherine thought, but her courage had thinned and dissipated when she'd walked into the kitchen and seen the pile of newspapers with their front page photographs of Jack and her and Maddie, one edition of which had fallen onto the floor, making small tents on the tiles. There were rock-hard bagels in a waxed paper bag on the table and a half dozen open cans of Diet Coke on the counter, although someone had thoughtfully taken the trash out of its bin, so the house didn't smell as awful as Catherine had feared it might. Climbing the stairs, she had opened the door to Jack's office and gazed at the pulled drawers and scattered papers on the floor, the strange nakedness of the desk without its computer equipment. She had known that the FBI would come with search warrants and documents, but she hadn't known precisely when. She had not been back to the house since the memorial service 2 days before Christmas, nor had Robert, who had returned to Washington immediately after the service. Shutting the door to Jack's office, Catherine had walked the length of the hallway, entered the spare room, and lay down on the bed. She was thinking that she'd been foolish to come back so soon, but she could not ignore her house forever. The clearing up had to be done. Julia, Catherine knew, would have come in her place, but Catherine could not allow that. Julia was exhausted, near to collapse herself, not only from the memorial service and the caring for Catherine and Maddie, but also from her own finely honed sense of obligation. Julia had been determined to fill the Christmas rush orders from the shop. Privately, Catherine had thought this misguided effort might kill her grandmother, but Catherine could not dissuade Julia from her sense of duty. And so the two of them, with Maddie helping sporadically, had spent several long nights boxing and packing and wrapping and ticking off names and addresses from a list. And in its own way, Catherine thought, the work had been mildly therapeutic. Julia and she had slept when they literally could no longer see, and thus they had avoided the insomnia that might have been their fate. This morning, however, Catherine had insisted that Julia stay in bed, and, not too surprisingly, Julia had finally acquiesced. Maddie, too, was sleeping late and might remain in bed until early afternoon, as she had been doing for days. Actually, Catherine wished her daughter would sleep for months in a peaceful coma and then awaken to a consciousness dulled by time, so that she would not be hit again and again with the pain that was always absurdly and cuttingly fresh. It was why Maddie slept so long, Catherine thought, to postpone that awful moment of knowing. Catherine wished she herself could manage a coma. Instead, she felt herself to be inside a private weather system, one in which she was continuously tossed and buffeted by bits of news and information, sometimes chilled by thoughts of what lay immediately ahead, thawed by the kindness of others, Julia and Robert and strangers, frequently drenched by memories that seemed to have no regard for circumstance or place, and then subjected to the nearly intolerable heat of reporters, photographers, and curious onlookers. It was a weather system with no logic, she had decided. No pattern, no progression, no form. Sometimes she was unable to sleep or eat or, most oddly, to read even a single article through to the end. And not because the subject matter was Jack or the explosion, but because she couldn't summon the necessary concentration. At other times, when speaking to Julia or Maddie, she couldn't get to the end of a sentence without forgetting what the beginning had been, nor could she remember from moment to moment what task it was that she had been engaged in. Occasionally, she found herself with a telephone to her ear, a number ringing, and no idea who it was she had called or why. Her mind felt crowded, as though there were a critical fact teasing her at the periphery of her brain, a detail she ought to be thinking about, a memory she ought to be seizing, a solution to a problem that seemed just beyond her grasp. Worse, however, were the moments of relative calm that suddenly gave way to anger, all the more confusing because she could not always attach the anger to the appropriate person or event. It seemed composed of bits, tiny stone chips of an ugly mosaic. Irritation at Jack, as though he were standing next to her, for something as trivial as the fact that he had neglected to tell her the name of their insurance agent, which she realized she could easily get, and did get, for herself by calling the company. Or for the infinitely more innocent yet utterly infuriating fact that he had left her for good. Or anger at Arthur Collar, with whom Jack had played tennis for years, for treating Catherine as though she were vaguely toxic when he'd met her one day at Ingerbretson's. Even the sight of a tourist couple touching in front of Julia's shop, this other couple intact when Jack and she were not, caused such a rage inside Catherine that she could not speak to them when they entered the store. Catherine knew that there were more appropriate and more obvious targets for her anger, but inexplicably, she most often found herself mute or helpless in the face of them. The media, the airline, the agencies with their acronyms, and the hecklers, disturbed and frightening hecklers on the telephone, in the streets, at the memorial service, and even once, mind-numbingly, on the television, when a woman asked for a man on the street comment about the crash investigation, turned to the camera, and accused Catherine of hiding critical information about the explosion. Shortly after her interview with the safety board investigator, Robert had suggested they go for a drive. They left the house and walked toward the car. He held the door for her, and only after it had closed did it occur to her to ask where they were going. St. Joseph's Church, he said quickly. Why? She asked. I think it's time for you to talk to a priest. They drove through Ely and then across the road that traversed the salt marsh and led into Ely Falls, past abandoned mills and storefronts with signs that hadn't been updated since the 1960s. Robert parked in front of the rectory, a dark brick edifice that needed scouring, a building Catherine had never entered. As a girl, she had often taken the bus into Ely Falls with her friends on Saturday afternoons and gone with them to confession at St. Joseph's. Sitting alone on a darkened pew, she had been entranced by the seemingly moist stone walls, the intricately carved wooden cubicles with their maroon drapes behind which her friends confessed their sins. What they'd been, Catherine could not now imagine. The captivatingly lurid paintings of the Stations of the Cross, which her best friend, Patty Reagan, had once tried without success to explain to Catherine, and the tawdry red glass globes that held the flickering candles that Patty would pay for and then light on her way out. Catherine's own childhood church, St. Matthew's Methodist, on High Street in Ely, had been almost aggressively sterile by comparison. A brown-shingled church, trimmed in yellow wood, with long multi-paned windows through which the sun bountifully shone on Sunday mornings, as though the architect had been specifically commissioned to include the light and air of Protestantism in his design. Julia had taken Catherine to Sunday school, though not much past the fifth grade, the age at which stories from the Bible no longer mesmerized her as they once had. And after that time, Catherine had not been to church much at all, except at Christmas and Easter with Julia. Sometimes Catherine had felt a small twinge of parental guilt at not sending Maddie to Sunday school, not allowing her daughter the opportunity to learn about Christianity and then decide its validity for herself, as Catherine had been allowed to do. Catherine guessed that Maddie hardly ever thought about God, although in this she knew she could be wrong. In the early years of their marriage, Jack had been aggressively scornful of the Catholic Church. He had attended the School of the Holy Name in Chelsea, with the worst that such parochial schools had to offer, including corporal punishment. It was hard for Catherine to imagine schooling much worse than her own, which had been so spectacularly dull that when Catherine thought about her years at Ely Elementary, the first image that came to mind was that of dust in the corridors. Lately, however, Jack's vehemence against the church had seemed to subside, and she wondered if he'd changed his mind. As he never talked about it, she couldn't say. They got out of the car and knocked on a large wooden door. A tall man with dark, wiry hair answered the bell. "There's been a terrible death," Robert said at once. The priest nodded calmly and gazed from Robert to Catherine. "This is Catherine Lyons," Robert said. "Her husband died yesterday in a plane crash." It seemed to Catherine that the color left the priest's face for just a moment and then returned. "I'm Father Paul Lefebvre," he said to both of them, extending his hand. "Please, come in." They followed the priest into a large room with leaded glass casement windows and seemingly thousands of books. Father Paul gestured for them to take seats around a small black fireplace grate. He looked to be in his late 40s, and he seemed unusually muscular and fit under his dark shirt. She wondered idly as she sat there what priests did to keep in shape, if they were allowed to go to the gym and lift weights. "I want to honor my husband," Catherine said when Father Paul had seated himself. He held a pad of paper and a pen in his lap. Catherine searched for more explicit words but couldn't find them. Father Paul nodded slowly and appeared to understand. Indeed, Catherine had the distinct impression throughout the interview that the Catholic priest knew a great deal more about her needs and her immediate future than she herself did. "I'm not a Catholic," she explained, "but my husband was. He was raised a Catholic and educated in Catholic schools. I'm sorry to say that he hadn't gone to church in quite a long time." There was a pause as the priest took this in. Catherine wondered why she had felt it necessary to apologize for Jack. "And what about yourself?" Father Paul asked. "I was raised a Methodist, but I haven't been to church much either." No, she thought, she and Jack hadn't gone to church on Sunday mornings. Sunday mornings, when Jack had been home, had been for waking in the bed with the burr of sleep upon them both, for the languid ease with which they would reach for each other, without a word between them, without the day between them, trailing dreams instead of responsibilities, and then afterward for lying in the crook of Jack's arm while he slept. "Are there other family members to inform?" the priest asked. Catherine hesitated and glanced at Robert. "No," she said, uncomfortably aware that she was lying to a priest in a Catholic rectory. "Tell me about your husband," the priest said softly. "He died yesterday when his plane exploded," she said. "He was the pilot." Father Paul nodded. "I read about it in the paper," he said softly. Catherine thought about how to describe Jack. "He was a good man," she said, "hardworking, loving. He had a special relationship with his daughter." Catherine pressed her lips together and tears instantly filled her eyes. Robert reached over and put his hand on hers. The priest waited patiently for her to compose herself. "He was an only child," Catherine said haltingly. "His mother died when he was 9, and his father died when he was in college. He grew up in Boston and went to Holy Cross. He fought in Vietnam. I met him later when he was a cargo pilot. Now he works for..." She stopped herself, shook her head. "He liked to fish and to fool around on the computer," she said when she could go on. "He played tennis. He spent a lot of time with Maddie, our daughter." These were the facts, she thought, but the real Jack, the Jack she knew and loved, wasn't in them. "He liked risk," she said suddenly, surprising the priest. "He didn't like rainy days. He blotted his pizza to get the oil off. His favorite movie was Witness. I've seen him cry at the end of sad movies. He couldn't tolerate traffic jams. He'd get off the highway and go 50 miles out of his way just to avoid one. He wasn't a particularly good dresser. He wore a uniform for work and never gave much thought to clothes. He had a leather jacket that he loved. He could be very tender and loving." She looked away. "And what about you?" the priest asked. "How are you?" "Me?" Catherine asked. "I feel like I've been beaten up." The priest nodded knowingly, like a therapist might, she thought. "And your marriage?" the priest asked. "What was your marriage like?" Catherine glanced at Robert. "It was a good marriage," she said. "We were close. I would say that we were in love for a long time, longer than most couples. Well, I don't know how you can ever tell about other people. It's just something you guess at." "And then what happened?" the priest asked. "And then," she repeated, "and then we just loved each other. We passed out of being in love to just loving." "Just loving is all that God asks of you," said the priest. Not once in her entire marriage, Catherine thought, had she considered what God wanted. "We'd been married 16 years, she said. The priest crossed his legs. "Captain Lyons has been returned?" "Returned?" she asked, at first bewildered. "The body," the priest said. "There isn't a body," Catherine said quickly. "My husband's body hasn't been found yet." "Then I assume you're speaking of a memorial service." Catherine looked to Robert for help. "I guess so," she said. "Well," Father Paul said, "we can do one of two things. We can hold a memorial service for Captain Lyons, in which case I'd advise you to do so before Christmas, so that the holiday might become part of the healing process, rather than of the tragedy for both you and your daughter." Catherine contemplated this idea, about which she did not feel hopeful. "Or," the priest added, "we could wait until your husband has been located." "No," Catherine said vehemently. "For my daughter's sake, for my sake, for Jack's sake, we need to honor Jack now. They're crucifying him in the papers and on television." She heard the word crucifying and felt embarrassed for having used it with a priest. But wasn't that in fact what was happening, she thought? They were crucifying Jack's honor, his memory. "They're saying that he committed suicide, that he murdered 103 people, Catherine said. "If Maddie and I don't honor Jack, I don't know who will." The priest studied her. "Honor him," she added, though she could not explain herself further. "And I..." She cleared her throat and tried to sit up straighter. "I doubt very much there will be a body," she said. That night, pacing sleeplessly in Julia's kitchen, long after Julia and Maddie had gone to bed, Catherine began to wonder if she shouldn't, after all, tell Father Paul that there was a living relative, Jack's mother. And wasn't it wrong of Catherine not to inform the woman herself that her son had died? She wondered. She suspected that it was, but the thought of Jack's mother alive, the image of an elderly woman who looked like Jack sitting in a nursing home caused for Catherine an unpleasant noise in the air, like the irritating and insistent whine of a mosquito that she wished would go away. It wasn't simply the discovery that Jack had lied to her that troubled Catherine. It was the continued existence of the woman herself, a woman Catherine did not know quite what to do with. Impulsively, Catherine reached for the telephone on the wall and called information. When she had the correct number, she dialed the nursing home. "Forest Park," a young woman answered. "Oh, hello," Catherine said nervously. "I'd like to speak to Madigan Rice." "Wow, that's amazing," said the woman, who was eating, Catherine thought, or chewing gum. "This is Mrs. Rice's third call today," the woman added, "and she hasn't gotten a call in, 6 months anyway." The woman made a sucking sound as if draining a drink with a straw. "And in any event," the woman continued, "Mrs. Rice can't come to the phone. She isn't well enough to leave her room, and in addition to all her other problems, she can't hear very good either. So a phone call is really out of the question." "How is she?" Catherine asked. "About the same." "Oh," Catherine said. She hesitated. "I was just trying to remember," she added, "when it was exactly that Mrs. Rice entered the nursing home." There was a silence at the other end. "Are you a relative?" the young woman asked warily. Catherine pondered the question. Was she a relative? Jack, for reasons of his own, had chosen not to acknowledge that his mother was alive, and so, for all intents and purposes, she hadn't been. Certainly not to Catherine or to Maddie. And Catherine wasn't at all sure to what end Madigan Rice should be resurrected. Was it shame that had made Jack lie about his mother? Had he and his mother had an irreparable falling out? "No, I'm not a relative," Catherine said. "There's going to be a memorial service for her son, and I wanted her to be informed." "Her son died?" "Yes." "What was his name?" "Jack. Jack Lyons." "Okay." "He was killed in a plane crash," Catherine added. "Really? You mean that vision crash?" "Yes." "Oh my God, wasn't that awful? What kind of a man would commit suicide and take all those innocent people with him?" Catherine was silent. "Well, this is the first I've heard of Mrs. Rice's son being on the plane," the woman said. "You want me to try to tell her? I can't promise you she'll understand." "Yes," said Catherine coolly. "I think you should try to tell her." "Maybe I'd better talk to my supervisor first. Well, listen, thanks for telling us, and I hope you didn't have any relatives yourself on that flight."
"I did, as a matter of fact."
"Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry."
"My husband was the pilot," Catherine said. In the days that followed her meeting with the priest, Father Paul and Catherine spoke often, and twice the priest drove to Julia's house to visit. At the first meeting at the rectory, Robert had stressed the need for security, and Father Paul had seemed not to think this was beyond his ken, although in this, as it happened, he was overconfident. Repeatedly, Catherine herself could get little farther than the word honor, though Father Paul did not demand much beyond that, and for that she was grateful. When she thought about Father Paul now, it was with a shudder of relief. For if it had not been for his firm hand, the memorial service would have been a fiasco beyond all proportions. As it was, she and Julia and Maddie had had to go to the church an hour ahead of time to ensure that they would have clear passage through the streets, which later would become so clogged that nothing, not even an ambulance, could get through. Maddie wore a long gray silk skirt with a cropped black jacket, and shook violently when Father Paul said that her father had now made a safe landing. Julia and Catherine had worn suits and had held hands, or rather, Julia had held Catherine's hand, and Catherine had held Maddie's, and this passing on of strength, this willing of strength from one to the other had helped Catherine, and she thought Maddie and Julia as well survived the service. But afterward, when Catherine stood up from the pew and turned to face the back of the church and saw the rows upon rows of pilots in dark suits, pilots from many airlines, most of whom had never met Jack, and then the rows of students from her classes, some of whom had already graduated and had come back for this event, she faltered and then stumbled, and it was Maddie, in a sudden reversal of roles, who held her up, supported her. Maddie and Catherine and Julia had then walked the length of that long aisle, and Catherine thought now that it had been possibly the longest walk of her life. For as she walked, she had the distinct sense that when she reached the door of the church and slipped inside the black car that was waiting for her outside, her life with Jack truly would have ended. The next day, in the newspapers, there was a photograph of Catherine emerging from St. Joseph's, and she was surprised not only by the repetition of her image on the front page of several papers in the stand outside Ingebretson's, but also by the image itself. Grief transformed a face, she saw, carved hollows and etched lines and loosened muscles, so that the face was almost unrecognizable. In the picture, clutching her daughter's arm for support, Catherine looked dazed and stricken and years older than she was. She winced now to think of that picture and of others, the most unfortunate being that of her and Robert in the shelter at the beach, Robert pulling at her sleeve, both of them looking momentarily cowed and cornered. It was, she thought, a particularly painful picture, because in actuality, Robert had been incensed by the photographer's shameless opportunism, and even now she could hear Robert shouting at the man as he climbed up the rocks and chased the photographer across the lawn. And then Robert's anger and the chase had so filled Catherine with righteous confidence that she had been moved to make her pronouncement when she entered the house, the pronouncement that had so quickly disintegrated when Summers had told her of Jack's mother. After that day at Ingebretson's, Catherine had stopped looking at newspapers or watching television. A visit to Julia's that was meant to last only the night following the memorial service extended through Christmas and beyond. Catherine, like Maddie, could not re-enter her own house, and she could not reasonably ask Maddie to return with her to their home until it had been cleared of any artifacts that might send Maddie spinning out the door. Only once at Julia's had the television inadvertently been left on, so that before Catherine had quite realized what was happening, she found herself looking at an animated rendition of the events following the explosion in the cockpit of Vision Flight 384. According to the sequence, the cockpit broke away from the body of the plane, which itself disintegrated into smaller fragments during a second explosion. The animation showed the trajectory of the various parts as they fell into the ocean. According to the reporter, the descent would have taken approximately 90 seconds. Catherine could not move her eyes away from the screen. She followed the arc of the small animated cockpit to the water, where it made a little cartoon splash and sank. The cloud layer, its milky swirls gradually thickening, dimmed the light in the window of the spare room. Catherine sat up in the daybed, determined to begin the cleaning now. She heard footsteps in the hallway and swung her legs over the side of the bed. It would be Julia, she thought, coming to help after all. But when Catherine glanced up, she saw that it was not Julia, but Robert Hart who was standing in the doorway. I went to your grandmother's, he said straight away, and she said you were here. He had his hands in the pockets of his sport coat, an indistinct, smooth color, taupe, maybe. He looked different in jeans. His hair was windblown, as though he had just combed it with his fingers. I'm not here officially, he said. I have a few days off. I wanted to see how you were doing. He stepped into the room. She wondered if he had knocked on the back door, and if he had, why she hadn't heard him. I'm glad to see you, she said, surprising herself. And it was true. She could feel a weight, not all of the weight, but something small and gelatinous, slide off her shoulders. How's Maddie? He asked, crossing the room and sitting down on the red lacquered chair. It would make an interesting photograph, Catherine thought suddenly, the man on the red lacquered chair against the lime green paint. An attractive man, an arresting face. The widow's peak and the dust-colored hair, combined with the way he sat, slouched with his hands in his pockets, made him look vaguely British, like a character in a World War II movie. Someone who would have been in ciphers, she thought. Terrible, Catherine said, feeling relieved to have someone to talk with about Maddie. Julia's fatigue had been such that Catherine had not wanted to burden her grandmother too much with her private worries. Julia's were harrowing enough, more than any 74-year-old woman should have to bear. Maddie's a mess, Catherine said simply to Robert. She's jumpy, she's nervous, she can't concentrate on anything. Sometimes she tries to watch television, but that's not safe anymore. Even if it isn't a news bulletin, there's always something that reminds her of her father. Last night, she went over to Taylor's house to be with some of their friends, and she came back inconsolable. A friend of Taylor's father who was at the house asked Maddie if there would be a trial, and Maddie apparently just dissolved. Taylor's dad had to drive her home. Robert, Catherine noticed, was studying her intently. I don't know, she said. I'm worried, Robert. Really worried. Maddie's brittle. She's fragile. She doesn't eat. Sometimes she breaks into hysterical laughter. She doesn't seem to have the appropriate reaction to anything anymore. Although I'd like to know what is appropriate. I told Maddie that life doesn't just disintegrate, that we can't break all the rules, and Maddie said, quite rightly, that all the rules had already been broken. He crossed his legs the way men do, an ankle resting on a knee. How was Christmas? He asked. Sad, she said, pathetic. Every minute was pathetic. The worst was how hard Maddie was trying, as if she owed it to Julia and me, as if she owed it somehow to her father. I wish now we had canceled the whole thing. How was yours? Sad, he said. Pathetic. Catherine smiled. What are you doing in here? He asked, looking around the room as though something in it might provide a clue. I'm trying to avoid having to clean the house. I've always used this room as a kind of retreat. I hide in here. What are you doing here? Is a better question. I have a few days off, he said. And? He uncrossed his legs and put his hands in the pockets of his trousers. Jack didn't spend his last night in the crew apartment, he said. In the room, the air went thick and heavy. Where was he? Catherine asked quietly. How quickly a person could ask a question she didn't want the answer to, Catherine thought, and not for the first time. As though one part of the psyche dared the other to survive. We don't know, Robert said. As you know, he was the only American on the crew. When the plane landed, Martin and Sullivan got in their cars and drove home. We do know that Jack went to the apartment, however briefly, because he made two phone calls, one to you and one to a restaurant for a reservation for that night. But according to the maid, no one slept there Monday night. Apparently, the safety board has known for some time. It will be on the news today, at noon. Catherine lay back on the bed and stared up at the ceiling. She hadn't been home when Jack had called, and he'd left a message on the machine. Hi, hun, he'd said. I'm here. I'm going downstairs to get something to eat. Did you call Alfred? Talk to you soon. I didn't want you to be taken by surprise, he said. I didn't want you to be alone. Maddie, she said. I've told Julia, he said. He got up, crossed the room, and sat at the bottom of the daybed, at its edge, barely sitting at all. His shirt was a darkish cotton, possibly gray, although Catherine wondered if it, too, could be called taupe. Her mind felt pushed, compressed. If Jack hadn't slept in the crew apartment, where had he been? She shut her eyes, not wanting to think about it. If anyone had asked her, she would have said that she was certain her husband had never been unfaithful. It wasn't like Jack, she wanted to tell Robert. That wasn't him at all. This will end, Robert said. It wasn't suicide. She felt compelled to say this, at least. She felt it absolutely. He reached over and put his hand on hers. Instinctively, she started to pull her hand away, but he held on to it. She didn't want to ask. She didn't, but she had to, and she could see that he was waiting for the question. She sat up slowly, withdrawing her hand, and this time Robert let it go. The reservation was for how many? She asked as casually as she could. For two. She pressed her lips together. It didn't mean anything, necessarily, she thought. It could easily have been for Jack and a member of his crew, couldn't it? She saw Robert's gaze flicker to the window and back. Which member of the crew? She wondered. How did you keep in touch with Jack when he was away? Robert asked. He called me, she said. It was easier that way because my schedule was always the same. He'd call me as soon as he got to the crew apartment. If I had to reach him, I would leave a message on his voicemail. We had arranged it that way because I could never be sure when he was trying to get some sleep. She thought about that arrangement. Had it been her idea or Jack's? They had done it for so many years she could no longer remember when it had begun. And it had always seemed a logical system, too practical to question. Odd, she thought, how a fact, seen one way, was one thing, and then, seen from a different angle, was something else entirely. Or perhaps not so odd. Obviously, we can't ask the crew, she said. No. She thought about the question Maddie had asked her on the day she'd learned of the suicide rumor. How do you ever know that you know a person? Catherine stood up and walked over to the window. She had on an old sweatshirt and a pair of jeans with shot knees that she had been wearing for days. Even her socks weren't clean. She hadn't thought she would see anyone today. With grief, she thought, appearance was the first thing to go. Or was it dignity? I can't cry anymore, she said. That part is over. Catherine, it's unprecedented, she said. It's absolutely unprecedented. No pilot has ever been accused of committing suicide in an airliner. Actually, said Robert, it's not unprecedented. There is one case. Catherine turned from the window. In Morocco, a Royal Air Maroc airliner crashed near Agadir in August of 1994. The Moroccan government, basing its opinion on the CBR tapes, said the crash was caused by the captain's suicidal act. Apparently, the man deliberately disengaged the autopilot and pointed the aircraft at the ground. The plane began to break up before impact. 44 people died. My God, she said. She put her hands over her eyes. It was impossible not to see, if only for an instant, the horror of the co-pilot as he watched his captain kill himself, the terrified bewilderment of the passengers in the cabin as they felt the sudden descent. When will they release the tape, she asked, Jack's tape. Robert shook his head. I doubt very much that they ever will, he said. They don't have to. The transcripts are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. When tapes have been released, either what's on them isn't sensitive, or else they've been heavily censored. So I won't ever have to listen to it. I doubt it. But then, how will we ever know what happened? 30 separate agencies in 3 countries are working on this crash, Robert said. Believe me, the union hates the accusation of suicide more than anyone, even the hint of suicide. Every congressman in Washington is calling for stricter psychological testing of pilots, which from the union's point of view is a nightmare. The sooner the case gets resolved, the better. Catherine rubbed her arms, trying to get the circulation going. "It's all political, isn't it?" she said. "Usually. It's why you're here." He was silent as he sat on the bed. He smoothed the bedspread with his palms. "No," he said, "not at the moment." "So you're here as..." "I'm here," he said, looking up at her. "I'm just here." She nodded her head slowly. She wanted to smile. She wanted to tell Robert Hart how glad she was that he was there, how very hard it was to go through all of this alone, to not have with her the one person she needed, who was Jack. "Is that a good shirt?" she asked quickly. "Not particularly," he said. "You feel like doing some chores?" Rain falls in heavy sheets outside the massive paned windows of the auditorium. The room is old and sloping, built in the 1920s and not yet renovated. The walls are wood-paneled, etched here and there with declarations of love and students' initials. Heavy maroon drapes that never seem to work exactly right hang to either side of the stage. Only the seats, mercilessly poked at and ripped open over the years with pens and pocket knives, have been replaced. Now the audience sits on seats removed from the Ely Falls Cinema when that building was demolished to make way for a bank. The auditorium slowly fills with parents as the band struggles courageously with pomp and circumstance. Conducting in the pit just below the stage, Catherine manages to coax from the 23 high school musicians a barely passable rendition of the graduation processional. Susan Ingalls on the clarinet is wildly off-key, and Spence Clausen on the bass drum seems particularly nervous tonight, hesitating just a fraction on each measure. Overtime, Catherine thinks to herself. In any other job, this would be called overtime. Fortunately, this is not graduation itself, just awards night. Catherine has 5 seniors in the band, 2 of whom might win academic prizes. It's one of the few advantages of a small school, she thinks. Awards night is usually short. With her baton still in her hand, she sits on a chair next to Jimmy DiMartino, tuba. She debates the merits of taking Susan Ingalls backstage and trying to tune her clarinet. The principal begins his address, which will be followed by talks from the vice principal and the valedictorian of the senior class. Catherine tries to pay attention, but her mind is more fixed on the grades she must do tonight when she gets home. The last several weeks of the school year are always harried and emotional. Every day for the past 5 days, she's conducted band practice during lunch so that the seniors, all 28 of them, can practice marching to pomp and circumstance for graduation. Not once this week has the song, even badly played, failed to produce tears. But by graduation night, Catherine knows, all the tears will be used up, the wistful heartache of leaving school will be well played out, and the seniors will be thinking only of the all-night party ahead. Every year it is the same. The speech is over, the principal begins to announce the awards. Catherine looks at her watch, a half hour at the outside, she calculates. Then the band will play Trumpet Voluntary, everyone will go home, and she can start computing grades for her sophomore history class. Maddie has a math final tomorrow. She hears applause, the hush of anticipation as a name is read. Another round of applause, sometimes a whistle from the crowd. Seniors from the front row of the auditorium mount the stage and return with ribbon-tied scrolls in their hands, occasionally a trophy. Beside her, Jimmy DiMartino receives an award for outstanding academic achievement in physics. She holds his tuba for him while he is on stage. After 30 minutes have passed, Catherine listens for the lull in the proceedings that will signal that the evening is coming to a close. In preparation, she stands and walks toward the conductor's box, making small motions with her hand to remind the musicians to pick up their instruments. She changes the music on the stand, waits with her hands folded in front of her to begin. But she is mistaken. The principal is not done. There is one more award to be given. Catherine hears the words highest possible score and sophomore. A name is called. A girl stands and hands Catherine her clarinet. In a white t-shirt, a skimpy black skirt, and work boots, the girl ascends the stage. The audience, in a mixture of admiration for the achievement and relief that the assembly is over, breaks into applause. Catherine tucks Maddie's clarinet under her arm and claps as hard as any of them. Jack should be here, Catherine thinks. Afterward, in the band room, Catherine smothers Maddie in a hug. I'm so proud, she says. Mom, Maddie says, breathlessly, breaking away. Can I call Dad and tell him? I really want to. Catherine thinks a moment. Jack is in London and will be sleeping in preparation for another trip, but she knows he wouldn't mind being woken for this. Sure, Catherine says to Maddie. Why not? We'll use the phone in the principal's office. Using her calling card number, she dials the crew apartment, but there is no answer. She hangs up and tries again. Through the window, she can see the wind sending gusts of rain down the street. Catherine tries a third time, thinking that the repetition of calls alone will signal to Jack that she's trying to reach him. It's 1:30 in the morning in London. Where is he? We'll call from home, she tells Maddie with a smile. But at home, when she dials the London number, there is still no answer. Catherine calls three times, twice while Maddie isn't looking. She leaves a message on the voicemail. Feeling the enthusiasm and pride of the evening beginning to dissipate, Catherine abandons the effort to reach Jack and to celebrate Maddie's achievement, makes up a batch of brownies. Maddie, too excited to study for her math test, sits at the kitchen table while her mother mixes the batter. For the first time ever, they discuss colleges, and Catherine thinks of schools she might not have considered before. She looks at her daughter in a slightly new way. When Maddie goes to bed, Catherine's forced good cheer begins to wane. She stays up late calculating grades. She calls the London number at midnight, 5 in the morning in London, and is frustrated to listen to the phone ringing in the crew apartment with no one to pick it up. In an hour, Jack will have to leave for the airport for his flight to Amsterdam and Nairobi. She begins to worry then that something serious may have happened to him. For a while, she vacillates between anger and concern until she falls asleep on the couch with her grade book and calculator on her lap. He calls at 1:45, 5:45 his time. His voice wakes her with punctuated bursts. Catherine, what is it? What's happened? Are you all right? Where were you? She asks groggily, sitting up. Here, he says. I was here. I just checked the voicemail. Why didn't you answer the phone? I had the ringer turned off. I was exhausted and had to sleep. I think I might be coming down with a flu. She hears the congestion in his voice. Airliners are notorious breeding grounds for colds. It's a good thing it wasn't an emergency, she says, allowing a note of pique to seep into her voice. Look, I'm really sorry, but I was so tired. I thought it was more important to sleep. So what is it? He asks. What's the news? I can't tell you. Maddie wants to tell you herself. It's nothing bad? No, it's great. Give me a hint. No, I can't. I promised. I don't suppose you want to wake her up now? No, she has a final in the morning. I'll call her from the air, he says. I'll time it so I call when she wakes up. Catherine rubs her eyes. There is a small silence over the phone. She would like to see her husband's face right now. She would like to crawl into the bed in the crew apartment with him. She has never seen the crew apartment. Sterile, he has described it, like a suite of hotel rooms. So, she says. Catherine, I really am sorry. I'll get the airline to get a system that bypasses the voicemail if it's an emergency. I'll get a beeper. She sighs into the phone. Jack, do you still love me? For a moment, he is silent. Why do you ask? I don't know, she says. I guess I haven't heard you say it in a while. Of course I love you, he says. He clears his throat. I really love you. Now go to sleep. I'll call at 7. But he doesn't hang up, and neither does she. Catherine, I'm here. What's wrong? She doesn't know precisely what is wrong. She has only a vague feeling of vulnerability, a heightened sense of having been left alone for too many days. Perhaps it is only being exhausted herself. I'm cool, she says, borrowing Maddie's expression of the moment. You're cool, Jack says. Yeah, whatever. She can almost see her husband smiling. Later, he says, and hangs up. Later, she says, holding the lifeless telephone in her hand. They moved from room to room, dusting, vacuuming, washing tiles, hauling trash, making beds, putting laundry into hampers. Robert worked at these tasks like a man, she noticed, sloppy with the beds, good in the kitchen, washing the floor there as though he were punishing it. With Robert in her bedroom and in Maddie's, potentially dangerous objects were diffused. A shirt flung over a chair was just a shirt that Robert tossed onto the floor with a bundle of other laundry. Bed linens were bed linens, in need of washing like everything else. He picked up discarded papers in Jack's office and, without examining them, as Catherine would have had to do, put them all into a drawer and closed it. In Maddie's room, Catherine felt Robert's scrutiny, sensing that he was afraid it would be in that room she would falter, but she surprised him and herself by being particularly speedy and efficient. Even more stoically, she had helped Robert take the Christmas tree down, both of them dragging the dried-out tree through the kitchen and out the back hallway, the tree shedding its needles on the floorboards and the tiles. By the time they were finished with the cleaning, the milky swirls in the sky had given way to low, lead-stained clots. It's supposed to snow, he said, spraying out the inside of the kitchen sink with the hose. She opened the cupboard beneath the sink and put away the bathroom cleaner, the pine saw, the Comet. She rinsed her hands in the spray from the hose and dried them on a dish towel. I'm hungry, she said, feeling the mild satisfaction that always came from having a clean house, like having had a bath. Good, he said, turning. I've got lobsters in the car. She raised an eyebrow. From Ingerbretson's, he explained, I picked them up on my way here. I couldn't resist. I might not have liked lobster, she said. I saw the picks and crackers in the silverware drawer. Observant, she said. Occasionally. But standing there, she suddenly had the sense that Robert Hart was always observant, always watching. Robert cooked the lobsters while Catherine set the table in the front room. A dry snow shower had begun, and swirls of snowflakes fell silently against the glass of the windows. Catherine opened the fridge and took out 2 bottles of beer. She had opened one and was about to open the other when she remembered that Robert didn't drink. She tried to put the 2 bottles back into the fridge without Robert's noticing.